Hey everybody, how the hell are you? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for listening, tuning in to it. Today on the show, Ann Jones will be here to talk about the war in Afghanistan. Well, she only spent a decade there. I think she's got a couple of things to say. Got a new one for Tom Dispatch. And actually, now that I think about it, who the hell else did I invite on the show today? Yeah, Nick Terse, but that does never work. Other than that, it might just be you and me. Maybe we'll take some phone calls and hang around. We've got lots of wars to talk about. Lots of wars. All right, well. I'm drinking coffee. It's cold. And I don't mean like iced coffee, like you'd do it like that on purpose. I mean, I forgot to drink some for a while, and all the heat went away. Oh, well. I'm going to have to make do with my partially caffeinated brain today. Okay. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is the website. We're now at 3,000, right? Wait a minute. Wait just a goddang minute now. I'm going to go see real quick. I think I was just a couple short, but then I've interviewed some people since then, right? Let's see here. I got to log in, man. Let's see. What if I click just the... Oh, first I got to go posts, then interviews. View all categories, interviews, and filter for just the interviews, please. 2,999 interviews posted at scotthorton.org right now. So, Ann Jones will be interview number 3,000. Ding, 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 ding. Hooray for her. Now, one of the things is that there's a lost Ivan Elin interview, and there's a lost Glenn Greenwald interview. Let's see, Elin from 04, Greenwald from what must have been 07 or 08. And then there was one time I interviewed this crank, and I ended up just deleting it because he was horrible. There might have been a couple like that. And then I interviewed David Thibodeau, the surviving Branch Davidian, twice on my first radio show, Say It Ain't So, on Free Radio Austin back in 1998, but those are lost to the world. I had my entire archive of my first radio show was just on cassette tape and was all stolen from my buddy's storage shed. He had the cheapest storage shed in town, which was nice for saving money on storage sheds, but it amounted to not very good security there. And they stole everything. And you know that my radio archive tapes just ended up in the garbage somewhere, probably thrown on the ground somewhere for dogs to pee on and the rain to fall on. And right? They were probably just littered. Nobody even used those tapes to make a mixtape of some crap music for someone that they cared about. Just trashed. Including my interviews with David Thibodeau. Including me predicting 9/11. Man, I wish I could prove that. I got the best clip that I'll never hear again. And you know, here's the funny thing about my radio show, my first radio show on Free Radio Austin, Say It Ain't So. Whenever I did a really good show, I'd be like, yeah, you know, because it was still all really exciting, you know, for me then. And I'd be done with the show, and then I would look at the tape recorder and realize that I had forgotten to hit record. Or maybe I had recorded the first hour, but then had forgotten to flip the tape during the break. Ah! But the one where I predicted 9/11, and with Till was the guy's name who was on the phone with me at the time, and we were having this great conversation. I was predicting the Iraq War, and he was predicting the Afghan one and all this stuff. In 98, that was on tape. I know it because I heard it. I went back and listened to that. I remember listening to it on tape. But, of course, can't prove it. I might be lying. I'm not. But I could be, because I could never prove it. And you know, what's funny is, my radio archives of my first radio show being stolen, that's the least of it. My buddy whose storage shed that they robbed, they took everything, man. His surfboards, his stuffed animals that his family had gotten him when he was two, that he'd saved his whole life, you know what I mean? His surfboards, did I say his surfboards already? His guitars, and man, he had some awesome guitars. And this is a guy who falls in love with his material objects. Like his guitars. Man, it was horrible. It was a nightmare. And then, and you know what it was too? He was living out of the country at the time. He came back, and the storage shed people swore that it only happened 2 days ago. You just missed him. I don't know. I remember being suspicious that maybe the storage shed guys were in on it. And we're kind of surprised to see him. By the way, if the thieves ended up becoming libertarians and are listening to this show now, and you ended up saving the archives of my radio show because it was so good, then, you know, email me. I can remote view my audio tapes laying in a ditch where somebody littered them out the window of a moving vehicle. That's what happened to them. Anyway. And it would be so cool, though, if I had those to just prove how smart I was way back when. Hey, guys, here's me in 1998 predicting that George W. Bush is going to get the nomination and take us to war. And the presidency. And take us to war. Anyway, what up? Who cares, Horton? No, nobody cares. If you're so smart, why ain't you rich? That's the slogan on my dad's desk. And it's a good question for him and for me, I guess. Different priorities. Maybe we're not that smart. Maybe if our priorities really were making money, we would do that. You know what's funny is if I had made making money my priority this whole time and had invested in the various Federal Reserve inflated bubbles, knowing as much as I do, I definitely would have got out of both of them on time. The big dot-com bubble and the housing bubble could have definitely been safe and cashed in and shorted Lehman Brothers and everything else. And I could have made millions and spent that money opposing war in ways way more effectively than sitting around doing this radio show the whole time, don't you think? If only I'd been more selfish and raised more money. Yeah, well. It's not like I'm going to learn that lesson and apply it. I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing. All right, so here's my thing about the government shutdown. Are you ready? Shut down the government. Am I the only one noticing here that they're not shutting down the national security state at all? You know, the state. They're shutting down the museums and the national parks. Is this working on anybody? And by the way, how could there possibly be anything called a non-essential government employee? First of all, how do you differentiate them from the ones who are essential? But secondly, aren't you admitting that they're just a bunch of useless job holders? And that your government is a make-work program for bums and losers and scumbags? Non-essential government employees. If they're not essential, how is it that their living is justified that they're justified in making a living off of taxes? Coerced out of people. Does that sound right to you? Non-essential government employees? Anything that even now, even under the Democrats, is classified as non-essential ought to be up for auction tomorrow. Where am I going off the rails here? What am I missing? And then, what about this government is supposed to be essential again? Let me tell you something. If I dream a genie came and took Washington, D.C. away and just made it go away, we could still be the USA. We don't have to have a capital city and a federal government and a standing army. We don't need a world empire. We don't need a police state. We don't need the FBI and the CIA and the IRS and the DEA and the ATF to have a civilization. You might notice that they're the worst practitioners of violence in our society. Look at the prisons. The worst madmen in our prisons are nothing compared to the people who run them. You kidding? We don't need them at all. I mean, come on. Use your imagination a little bit. What if there was no federal government? What if a government shutdown actually meant a shutdown of the government? Unless you're a government contractor, or a government employee, or a government grant recipient, then what are you other than richer and freer? I don't know. It's just funny to me seeing people wringing their hands over this. Oh no, a government shutdown. Really? After all the experiences you've had in your life, oh no. Oh no. Is your reaction to a government shutdown? I don't understand that. These people who burn people to death. I mean, like, the New York mob shut down. And they're nice guys compared to the U.S. government. I don't know. The Al-Qaeda shutdown. How about that? Oh, no. I heard there's an Al-Qaeda shutdown. Yeah, but those guys are simply the enemies of humanity. So, that's great. We're happy to hear. Right? Let's see. Who kills more innocent people? Al-Qaeda or the USA? Oh, no. But Al-Qaeda targets innocent people. The Americans just don't care at all how many innocent people die in their carpet bombing raids. Oh, okay. You're right. That's a pretty significant difference. That's like the difference between whether the CIA deliberately targeted the black community for destruction with their massive oversupply of cocaine into South Central Los Angeles in the 1980s, or whether they were just making money for their secret illegal death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and they just didn't care what happened to the blacks of LA. It's a huge distinction without a difference, really. But anyway, I don't know. I hate the government. Don't you hate the government? Okay, good. Boo-hoo, a government shutdown. You should see my Twitter feed. And this is, you know, my fault for my choice of people that I follow on Twitter, I guess. I follow a lot of liberals on Twitter because liberals do a lot of journalism. It's at least worth knowing about. Conservatives, not so much. They just believe things. But yeah, the things liberals believe, boy. Cry me a river about a government shutdown. I'll give you a minute to go change your wet panties. And I don't mean in the hot way. I mean in the cowardly terror kind of incontinence sort of a way. All right. And you know what? As long as I'm talking about things at random here that no one expected. Here's one by Nick Bauman, who, isn't he the guy from Rolling Stone? Haven't I interviewed him before? He's a good liberal. Nick Bauman is not a right-wing reactionary of any kind. Of any kind. He's a good liberal. And here he is writing in Slate that Neville Chamberlain was right to not start a war over Czechoslovakia. And this is, of course, in reference to the fallacy of 39 as Justin Logan at Cato calls it. This is what the neocons always say about all of Israel's enemies, of course, is that it's always 1938, and whoever their enemy is Hitler. And if we don't start a war first, well, then just look at what happened when we didn't start a war with Hitler first. He ended up starting it, and it ended up being really big and bad, and we should have invaded in 36, I guess, or something. They never really finish the argument, do they? There's a great clip, actually, of some right-wing blowhard radio host on the Chris Matthews show going, "Munich! Chamberlain! Munich!" And Chris Matthews, who I despise, but still, says, "Oh yeah, what's Munich? What does that mean?" And the guy didn't even have any idea that, well, first of all, it's a city where there was a peace conference, quote-unquote, and Neville Chamberlain was the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, and Hitler was, Hitler. No, he didn't know. He had no idea. All he knew was, if somebody doesn't want to start a war, you're supposed to chant, "Munich! Chamberlain!" at them. And of course, the theory being that the Brits were trying to appease Hitler, and of course, Chamberlain naively returned to England, waving the piece of paper over his head and saying that, "I have achieved peace in our time. I'm the only one who knows how to manipulate this Hitler guy, and look at what a great job I'm doing," he said, that kind of thing. And anyway, so here's Bauman at Slate saying, "Come on, man, what's the counterfactual here? What was he supposed to do? Field an army in Czechoslovakia? Get the French to invade? Germany from the West? Britain wasn't ready for a war at the time. They needed at least another year or more." But then here's my problem, and I think he makes a good point. But here's my problem. He doesn't go on and ask, what good was it giving a war guarantee to Poland? Now, Pat Buchanan is a right-wing reactionary of some kind, and maybe you just don't like Pat. I know, you either love Pat or you don't love him at all, I guess, is the thing. I love the guy. I can't help it. And I disagree with him terribly on extremely important issues, too. But I still love him. Old Squinty. And anyway, I don't care if you don't like him or not. I still think he makes a great argument in his book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. The Unnecessary War, that's a quote from Churchill himself. He's the one, he basically says, you know what? We shouldn't have done that. About World War II. We should have just let the Nazis fight the communists. Hitler was going east. He wanted to take Danzig and Poland. He was going to occupy Poland. Whether he divided Poland with Stalin, I mean, I think that was a tactic because of the war guarantee. But whatever, if he'd invaded Danzig and taken Danzig, he would have ended up owning all of Poland and then sharing a border with Russia. And then the war between the German Nazis and the Russian communists would have been on 3 years earlier, 2 years earlier. Almost 2 years earlier. And, you might have seen both totalitarian dictatorships destroyed instead of the Soviet Union preserved all the way through 1991. And Poland still enslaved all the way through 91. It's not like Britain protected Poland. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And look, I know that World War II is sacred. It's the real founding myth of America now. It's not George Washington and the cherry tree, or even Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. It's World War II is the founding myth of the American Empire. And what a great one, because you got the devil incarnate in the form of Hitler and his Nazis, and for that matter, the Imperial Japanese. Absolute monsters. So, it's pretty easy to be the good guys compared to them, but it doesn't mean that the policy was smart or, you know, even well thought through at all. And in fact, here's the thing about Neville Chamberlain that people usually leave out. It's not like the day after Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia that Churchill took power and then the war and then what happened was that night Neville Chamberlain, in an emotional fit, humiliated by Hitler's breaking of the Munich deal, issued the war guarantee to Poland. This is the issue that Nick Bauman ignores in his article here. Is that the only reason that Chamberlain gave the war guarantee to Poland in the first place was because he wasn't thinking. It's because he was angry, red in the face, and stomping up and down. He'd been made to look like a fool. And then he thought that if he gave the war guarantee to Poland, that that would make Hitler back down. He wasn't saying, yeah, I know, we should have a war with the Germans, but we should let the Polish colonels, who were basically a bunch of Nazis themselves, we should let them decide when we get into a war. No, he thought that, well, if we give a war guarantee to Poland, that'll make Hitler finally back down, when no, it didn't. All it meant was a war between the Western democracies and Hitler, when he had been going east. Stupid. And here's the thing about it. And again, you know what? I'm sorry. I know people, a lot of times Pat Buchanan rubs them the wrong way or whatever, but you read his book, he knows that. And if you read his book, you'll notice that all of his footnotes are just from English historians, basically. It's all English historians telling you that, yeah, that was stupid. Yep, and that was stupid. Yep, and that was stupid. Because, you know, he's protecting his flank from those kinds of accusations that he's somehow a Hitler supporter or something. He's just saying, this is just a series of immeasurable blunders. And, you know, Lord Grey and all of the chancellery of the military and the whatever all their offices are called, they all completely flipped out when they heard about the war guarantee to Poland. They said that Neville Chamberlain should be locked in an insane asylum. They said things along the lines of, he bloody well did what now? He gave a war guarantee to who? Huh? Because they all knew the obvious thing to do here is let the Nazis fight the Soviets. And you know what? Tough for everybody stuck between them in the bloodlands there. Real tough. Very tough. Horribly tough. But again, the Brits didn't field an army in Poland to protect them from the Germans or from the Soviets. Poland was ruined and enslaved and massacred anyway. And I think probably what would have happened is Hitler would have defeated the Soviet Union, would have probably killed Stalin, sacked Moscow, but then been defeated by the Russian people, who are very patriotic, and by the winter. Which, you know, anybody could tell you, you can't really invade and conquer Russia because the snow. So anyway, it's not a perfect counterfactual what would have happened instead. But at the time, it's not like this is all hindsight 2020 either. At the time, it was well recognized that the policy ought to be let the dictators fight. Why in the world would you provoke Hitler into turning west? Invading and conquering France and Belgium and Denmark and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, yeah. I think it's important to talk about this, not because I'm the master historian on World War II and whatever, but obviously I'm on to something, even if you don't quite buy it. And I think it's important to show that this is not all just, it wasn't all just set in stone. It happened the way it happened because individuals made decisions. Good ones and bad ones. And it didn't have to be that way. But it was. And the problem is, especially when you're talking about wars that happened before you were born, it's sort of, it's all in black and white pictures and whatever. It's kind of whatever. These are just the facts of the world, right? This is ancient history kind of a thing. And especially on that war, where, again, the opponents of the Allies were evil incarnate in the form of the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese, it's such a perfect morality, you know, tale and fable about, and of course, to this day, about how it's the best and truest thing in the world that America replaced the British Empire as the global hegemon. Because, you know, we're Superman. We're the good guys. And we save the innocent from the Hitlers that come to destroy them. You know, we heard this 2 weeks ago in reference to Bashar al-Assad in Syria. In Syria. That he's Hitler and poison gas and yeah. And so we got a bomb. And luckily, I think that's finally wearing a bit thin. But anyway, it just seems crazy how the worst thing that ever happened in the world, 60 million killed, is the example, is the benchmark for what's good and great about America and American foreign policy. And now it's true that only a few hundred thousand Americans died in it. The war didn't really touch our shores. Yeah, a couple of little Japanese skirmishes here and a German saboteur there or something, but really, the whole thing happened everywhere but here. So Americans remember World War II as a time of rations and stuff, but not as a time of their cities all being burnt to the ground, you know? But it was the worst thing that ever happened. And it's worth keeping an open mind as to how it happened and whether it had to be that way at all. Of course, the primary blame rests on the shoulders of Woodrow Wilson. Because by his intervention, bringing America into World War I, that tipped the balance in favor of the Allies against the Central Powers so strongly that it led to the rise, led to the rise of the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, World War II, the American Empire, and the rest of it. You can read my article, Blame Wilson, if you want the 2,000-word version of that. All right, we'll be right back with Ann Jones in just a minute. And yeah, I'll play your request too. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. 2,999 interviews available for you at ScottHorton.org. In fact, by the time many of you hear this, this will be the 3,000th interview there, posted in the archives at ScottHorton.org. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right. So now for interview 3000. Welcome to the show, Ann Jones.
Thank you. I'm honored to be number 3000. That's great.
Wonderful. Well, I'm very happy to have you here and back on the show, I should say, and very happy to read you at tomdispatch.com. 99.999% chance this one will be running in the archives at antiwar.com tomorrow under Tom's name, is how that usually works with his little introduction there. But this is called Americans Can't Remember, Afghans Will Never Forget. And I like the way you start this thing, reminding us about ancient history here, an American intervention in Afghanistan dating all the way back to Ike Eisenhower and the 1950s. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, that was the raging Cold War, and so there was immense competition between the Soviet Union and the United States for influence in many parts of the world, but Afghanistan was seen as a particularly strategic part of Central Asia there. So there used to be jokes about the Afghan leaders would light their Cuban cigars, courtesy of the U.S. and drink their Russian vodka along with it. So, both sides were actively campaigning there, and the U.S. had an enormous project in Helmand province, where your listeners may remember some of the most desperate fighting of the U.S. Marines took place just in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So we go back a long way in history, though, in Helmand province.
I guess in my imagination, Anne, I guess I always just figured that Stalin and the Soviets took over all of those states, Tajikistan and Afghanistan and the rest of them after World War II, no? It was an independent country in the 50s, huh?
Well, they were working in all of those countries at that time, but of course Afghanistan was independent. It was not part of the Soviet Union. So there was the competition between the outside superpowers for influence there, mm-hmm. and it was strategically important to both of them. But the U.S. at that time was trying to exert peaceful influence by developing agricultural projects, and it helped to develop the university and so on. And there were various European countries also providing aid at that time. But each country was trying to remake the Afghanistan in its own image a bit. And it's never been successful, either when we've tried it peaceably or more recently when we've tried it through war.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, to hear Zbigniew Brzezinski tell it now, it was his bright idea to deliberately initiate covert action against the Soviet-backed regime in the late 1970s in order to provoke them into full-scale intervention on his behalf, on the communist dictator's behalf, that way to give them, quote, their own Vietnam, sort of like we're giving ourselves right now. But I wonder if you buy that. Some people have said that they think that that's just kind of revisionism. He's trying to take credit for how, you know, supposedly well it worked out in bankrupting the Soviet Union, et cetera.
Well, he did have to have some sort of presidential finding from Carter, who was president at the time. So I think there is documentation, although I haven't seen it myself, but I think there is documentation to support his claim. He made that claim only a long time after the fact in an interview with a French magazine. But I believe it's generally accepted now that, yes, the CIA was active in trying to engage in activities in Afghanistan that provoked the Soviets to come in, because there was an indigenous Afghan communist government in power at the time, and we were trying to subvert them and the Soviets. According to Brzezinski, he was trying to draw the Soviets in to save that communist government. And the rest is history, that long proxy war that we fought against the Soviets, or that the Afghans fought against the Soviets, and that the U.S. and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia financed for a decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it interesting how Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he's not the only one, you don't have to be as smart as old Zbig to figure out that, you know, Vietnam makes a great kind of saying, a byword for disastrous, no-win quagmire that you shouldn't have done in the first place and didn't do you any good at all and cost you a bunch of money and was really wish you hadn't have done that, right? You just pack all that into the word Vietnam. We'll give them their own Vietnam. And the logic of it is perfect, right? What better way to weaken the Soviet Union? Never mind containing them. Go ahead and encourage them to overexpand and weaken themselves. But then this is exactly what we're doing to ourselves. We call ourselves so smart for learning the lesson of Vietnam. And then we do it to the Russians. Ha ha, how do you like that? Spy versus spy. We're so smart. We got you. And then we do it to ourselves, and...
Well, I believe that's a classic case of somebody else's history being repeated by ourselves. You know, there were some very amusing statements made by the more recent Russian ambassador to Afghanistan, who kept talking to the press about how his American friends were now repeating every mistake that the Soviets had made in Afghanistan. And he was saying precisely what the Soviets had done wrong. And it got to be quite ironic when he started mentioning mistakes the Soviets had made that the U.S. hadn't quite made yet, and then very shortly thereafter, the U.S. would be sure to make them. So, yeah, we followed right in their footsteps and did all the same things wrong.
All right, now, so part of this whole war for that's gone on so long now, but part of it is, you know, to hear the Americans talk about it, there's just the Afghan people. And I'm a melting pot kind of guy, and, you know, I don't want to encourage any sort of chauvinism or whatever, but it seems to me that the old world is just lousy with this kind of, you know, ethnic, sectarian, tribal separatism, and that really there is no Afghanistan unless there's some British-backed king ruling the place with an iron fist or something like that. Really, there's Pashtunistan that the Brits divided in half with their Durand line, and then there are Tajiks and Uzbeks and whatever's, you know, different Hazaras in the coalition that backs the government in Kabul. But the Americans seem, at least, you know, to elementary eyes, to approach this thing as though none of that stuff is true. That, like, you know, this is just a place with a bunch of people on it, and we're going to have a democracy now, and we're going to go along basically trying to implement the program as we sell it to the people, you know, kind of a thing, right? The shtick that they give us about how we're creating a democracy and taking care of women's rights and all these things that they tell the American people to get us to support it, that actually sort of kind of becomes the program for the occupation, even though it's not taking into reality who's who and what they want. Am I making sense, and am I even right at all, do you think?
I think you are right, yes, of course. Following that proxy war we talked about was an enormous civil war between these seven Mujahideen factions that we had been backing. And, of course, they represented, although they were all Islamist extremists, they also came from the various different ethnic groups. So they represented different ethnicities, different parts of the country, and they went to war with each other. They were aligned together against the Soviets, but when that was over, they started battling one another. And that still continues. It still persists. So that today, well, President Karzai, of course, is Pashtun, and he has a Tajik first vice president and a Hazara second vice president. And now that the... Hello?
Yes, ma'am. I'm taking notes diligently.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I'd lost you here.
Nope.
Now at this particular period, the candidates for the 2014 election to succeed President Karzai are registering. They have to be registered by the 6th. And so they're all busy scurrying around behind the scenes trying to make their ethnic alliances with candidates for first and second vice president to strike just the kind of balance that you were talking about.
And is there any hope for that? I mean, I don't mean to be too cynical about this. If democracy means power sharing between different factions working together in a parliament or something, and they can really figure out a way to do it, I'm all for that. You know, it's certainly better than everybody just bombing each other all day.
Well, we're talking about among the candidates, of course, it's all the usual suspects. It's all the same old warlords. Afghans would call most of them, or a great many of them, war criminals. So it's a lot of the same guys who destroyed the country in the civil war in the early 1990s who are now making these alliances to try to gain control of the government. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I would go so far as to call it democracy, but it is a kind of power sharing in which, you know, you have to get guys from the other side into your little group to put yourself forward for the election. And then we have that, presumably we will have that election, and things are lining up so there's room for a great deal of fraud. Mm-hmm. Millions more election cards, voter cards floating around the country than there are eligible voters. So they will be for sale, and people will be out stuffing ballot boxes. And then after the election, we will have another kind of jockeying for position, and that is trying to determine whether the candidates who have lost will actually accept the results of the election and maintain peace with a government that they may not be part of, or whether, as they have done in the past, they will just have another round, this time with weapons.
Yeah. Well, and so... Yeah, the power sharing that we're talking about basically is the compromise between Karzai and General Dostum and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and these guys. This doesn't include the Afghan people at all, or even the Taliban, right?
Well, yes, many of the people in the government now are Taliban sympathizers or former Taliban people. I mean, many former Taliban officials are part of Karzai's appointed high peace commission. So, you know, they sort of maintain this myth that this government is one side and the Taliban is another side. But there are lots of Talibs in the government already. They just changed their turbans and don't call themselves that anymore.
Mm. And yet, as you write in your article, the Taliban fighting force out there in the field continues killing so-called Afghan army guys at pretty high rates out there.
Well, what's happening to with the Afghan army now is really kind of a tragic slaughter, I think. I mean, the U.S. has supposedly trained this army up to defend the government. And now the Taliban is really going for them, and they're being killed at a terrible rate, hundreds. And of course, they don't have the medical facilities that the American soldiers had. They don't have the benefit of that to the extent that the Americans have it. So the rates at which the celebrated Afghan National Army is dying now is certainly not sustainable. So that's another bad indicator that that things can't go on like this.
Well, now, so what do you think Obama's policy is, or does he have one at all? Because, you know, he tells us, he said again on TV last night in a message to the troops, I think, the war in Afghanistan is going to end next year. But then he works a deal, he signs a deal, right, saying we'll stay and help you at least through 2024. And, you
well,
know, obviously
that
they're...
hasn't been signed.
I'm sorry?
No, he's trying to get what he calls a bilateral security agreement. They want to leave. They want the U.S. wants to maintain control of 9 or 10 of their most important bases, and they want to have several thousand. The usual figure that's repeated is 10,000 trainers in the country. A lot of that, of course, will be special forces and CIA and goodness knows what else. But Karzai is being very coy about it, and he has kept postponing signing such an agreement. And you remember, this is, if you remember the war in Iraq, you'll recognize this scenario where the U.S. is trying to sign an agreement to keep troops in the country, and the leader keeps kicking the can down the road and putting it off. We wanted to have this agreement before the election so that we wouldn't have to run the risk of having to renegotiate it after a different president is elected. But Karzai has not agreed to that. And so now I see today that Chuck Hagel is saying he wants that agreement signed by the end of next October. So he's put it off for a year, but that's cutting it pretty close to the time that the troops are supposed to exit altogether.
Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, it seems like the major difference is what you just said about the soldiers out there, that their casualty rates are unsustainable. Whereas, I mean, and really the entire situation is different, where in Iraq, once the Iraqi National Alliance and their, you know, Badr brigades basically became the Iraqi army and, you know, so-called cleansed all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad, they didn't need us anymore. Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Bye. Thanks for, you know, everything, but now you can leave. Whereas it sounds to me like the, whatever you call this government in Karzai, is going to need America to continue being the government. You know, otherwise, Mullah Omar is just going to come riding back into town and standing up in a Jeep or something, right?
Well, you know, Karzai can't run, and we have no idea what this government is going to be or whether people will support it. I mean, now large numbers of people are contributing to the support of the Taliban, giving money and supplies and so on to the Taliban. Money is collected in, you know, from people working in the Karzai government and throughout Kabul and the cities to go to support the Taliban, because this really, the Americans really are an army of occupation now to, in the eyes of a great many Afghans, and it's an infidel army, and they want them out of there. So it's very difficult to predict if whether Afghans will be loyal to another elected government as long as the infidels have left, or whether they will oppose that elected government as well as something that is a leftover by the infidels. I have no idea. And I think if you talk to people in Kabul, you'll hear many, many different opinions. And the upshot is that nobody has a clue what's really going to happen. And that's what makes it so scary to people there trying to figure out their own future.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it seems to me like, well, from an economics point of view, it's sort of like America has inflated a power bubble where, you know, these guys, their price is a lot higher than the market would really reflect, if you understand what I mean. And that when America goes, they're going to go too. It's unlike Iraq, where it was a minority dictatorship and America fought to install the majority in power. So you can even call that a democracy and leave because, you know, the majority is going to get their way in the parliament and whatever. You know what I mean?
Well, let's not be too, you know, let's not overemphasize too much what happened in Iraq. I mean, Iraq is the scene today of some of the most terrible violence since 2008. Iraqis are dying at the rate of 6,000 so far this year. Iraqi civilians dying through suicide bombs, car bombs, sectarian cleansing. The war continues in what lots of people on the scene are just calling a continuation of civil war. You know, the U.S. has this habit of going in, making a war, overturning a regime, and then saying, "Okay, we're done now. We're leaving." But the war doesn't end when the Americans leave. It often just gets started.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean to imply that Iraq was some.
It's very possible that what's happening in Iraq now can happen in Afghanistan as well.
Sure. Yeah, I didn't mean that the surge worked in Iraq was peace now or anything like that. Just that they succeeded in kicking all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad. They're not about to take it back now. I mean, there might be a lot of truck bombings, but they lost that part of the civil war anyway, the control of the capital city. It just seems like it's not so clear in Afghanistan. When America intervened in Afghanistan, the Northern Alliance was on the verge of ceasing to exist. And this whole time they've been able to rule Kabul and whatever other parts of the country from time to time simply due to American power. Right?
Well,
whereas Maliki still
actually
has an army without us.
You're absolutely right, Scott, that Afghanistan seems in many ways much more complicated. But it's not as though the U.S. has supported one side or another at the expense of the other. I think the Afghans have had it's more a question of who the Afghans have attached themselves to rather than who we've picked to support. And in many cases, I think the U.S. has been clueless about how to play this game in Afghanistan because it is so complicated.
Yeah. So really the American influence is so little at this point that it's really not the American sock puppets that rule Kabul, other than maybe, you know, Karzai that they picked way back when.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say who's in charge of anything these days. I mean, that's the situation now is really like everybody's on the edge of a cliff and sort of leaning over to see if there is any way down, sort of just jumping off. People really are very edgy, very nervous, not knowing what's going to happen. And even look at this period we're in now of about 3 weeks when political candidates had to pick up their papers to register to be a candidate for president and return them. And as I said earlier, they have to be returned by October 6th. So we're getting to the end of that period now. 72 candidates, potential candidates, including two women, picked up registration papers. And as of yesterday, only one of them had returned the papers. I see today that two more are said to be registering today. That's in the press, but it's still not official. and they're still jockeying for their vice presidential candidates. And most of these guys are still hanging back, trying to do their deals in the back room. Mm. And it's going to come right down to the 5th and 6th of October before we see who's actually running for president.
And whatever happened...
Meanwhile,
oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please. What were you asking?
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, whatever happened to Abdullah Abdullah, who was the Obama and the CIA's pick to replace Karzai for a minute there back in 09?
Well, he supposedly filed his papers today. That's reported in the press, but not officially from the Election Commission. Mm-hmm. And he has been working to form a coalition and has a lot of support. He is actually quite popular. And that last election, you know, the stuffing of the ballot boxes was so apparent, and the corruption in the election was so apparent that a lot of people thought Abdullah had done much better than the official results showed, and he was eligible to call for a rerun with just himself and Karzai in the race. But he declined because he thought that would be just as fixed. And also he was under pressure from the international community not to insist upon a rerun because of the expense of staging another election and the potential for conflict. So he retired very gracefully in 2009 and was very vocal in urging his followers to accept the results and not make any trouble or protest in any way. And he's probably the most civilized sort of candidate you can get. And a lot of people are eager to see him run and see the coalition that he puts together. He's the hope of a lot of, among the ex-warlords, he is the best hope of those who are more progressive.
All right. Well, we're all out of time. We'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for coming back on the show. I appreciate it, Ann.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Scott.
Sure, appreciate it. All right. That is Ann Jones. She's reported from Afghanistan since 2002. And she's the author of Kabul in Winter. And the new one is, did it already come out? It's coming out. They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story. You can read her brand new one at tomdispatch.com. It'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow, I'm sure. Americans can't remember. Afghans will never forget. And we'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. All right. So what you missed there was my spot for LibertyStickers.com. People say to me things like, Scott, you just thinking bumper sticker slogans, man. Answers aren't always so easy. Yeah? Well, you're right. I do. And I sell my hateful bumper sticker slogans in vinyl form, sticky or magnetized, at LibertyStickers.com. That's right, most of those were made up by me when I was pissed off about something. I made up a new one the other day, but I haven't made it yet because my stole version of Adobe Illustrator crashes every time I try to open it. One of them is just going to be, I got a couple new ones. One of them is just going to be a quote of Benjamin Netanyahu saying that American support for Israel is absurd. I happen to agree with him about that. And then I can't tell you the other one because, you know, then you might go and copyright my slogan, man. Can't have that. All right, so listen here. I'm going to talk about very important things in very interesting ways, and you're going to love it. But I got special requests for music representing the failure of the American state to even perpetuate itself. I mean, you know, come on, this whole shutdown is a sham, but at least symbolically, it's nice to see them stepping all over their own foot. I can't play the whole songs of these, just parts, you know. All right, how many of y'all think of Streets of Fire when you see this? Hear it, I mean. I was seeing it, so that's why I said see it. All right, y'all, it's the show. God dang, I like Public Enemy a lot. Good old Public Enemy. That's really my favorite. You might already know this about me. Beastie Boys and Public Enemy. Yes, I still live in 1986, I guess. It was a good year for me. I started skateboarding that year. All right. It's actually not my favorite album by them. But then again, yeah, man, there's some good ones on there. Hell yeah. In fact, that's not my favorite one on there. But anyway. So, yeah, Shut Them Down. It's a bit obvious. But then again, it's a good song, so yeah, listen to it. Yeah. So, anyway, government shutdown. I wish they would shut down the government. How come when there's a government shutdown, they don't shut down the government? You think any of the so-called furloughed employees are going to actually take a pay cut? Or they're all just barbecuing on your dime on a work day? This whole thing is ridiculous. I guess that's the best thing about it, is how ridiculous it is. And I don't know. The thing that bums me out, though, remember that survey they did back in, say, 2000 and I'm going to call it 8? Maybe it would have been 2009. Anyway. Hell, you can Google it. Google what? The survey that says the American people don't like the government, don't trust the government, don't believe the government. But you know what they do trust? You know what institution is their very favorite? That's right, the Pentagon. So, if it ever comes to the real worst crisis, you can count on probably even super majorities of the American people to turn to the military to fix the broken civilian government for us. And you know, you might think that would just be kind of a right-wing point of view about military worship, fighting for our freedom, and even if they're locking you in a emergency camp or something, hey, they're fighting for our freedom. We love the military no matter what. Liberals are really bad on this too. In fact, liberals, a lot of times, they feel all this pressure to prove how militaristic they can be so that you don't call them a patchouli stinking hippie, right? They'll end up being more militaristic than a conservative half the time. And then, for example, you have Nicholas Kristof, who's, you know, the walking definition of the center-right in American, the center-left, same difference, mirror image kind of thing. The center-left in American politics, basically a good liberal Democrat, right? Nothing too radical about him or anything. He's just, you know, he's like Hillary Clinton, basically, in his politics, a centrist Democrat. And he wrote this whole thing about a year ago or so about how America, the nation state, ought to be a hell of a lot more like America, the army. And we ought to have a commander like David Petraeus, who everyone agrees is really, really competent, because after all, the Washington Post never wrote about anyone who disagreed with that. And so there you go. And we ought to have somebody like him in charge. And then we ought to have, you know, frankly, socialism. And here's Kristof pointing at the military and saying this is proof that socialism is an efficient and beneficial way to run your society. Even the lowliest grunt gets up at 5 a.m. and is productive under the influence of his commanding officers. America could be great again if only we were all conscripts in a military dictatorship. call it National Socialism, wrote Nicholas Kristof. I mean, I'm paraphrasing at the end there. But Nicholas Kristof wrote that in the New York Times. I'm sorry, I would have said New York Times in the first place, but part of my brain was telling me it was the Washington Post. You heard the later allusion to the Washington Post. But that wasn't right. But then when it occurred to me that, no, I wrote that in the New York Times, then I could picture it, and I knew that that was right. Yeah, it was in the New York Times. Nicholas Kristof. America, the country. America, the civilian population. Ought to live like the U.S. Army. Oh, good. Benjamin Netanyahu's at the United Nations. Preaching in English. Oh, wait a minute. I got on the wrong channel here. I got freaking ridiculous MSNBC on. Worthless. How did I decide to put it on MSNBC this morning? It's on C-SPAN 3? Where the hell is it? No. Is it on CNN International? They're doing sports right now, aren't they? Oh, no, there he is. All right.
Of tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in Syria. And that regime is propping up a Syrian regime that just used chemical weapons against its own people. Rouhani condemned the, quote, violent scourge of terrorism. Yet in the last 3 years alone, Iran has ordered, planned, or perpetrated terrorist attacks in 25 cities in five continents. Rouhani denounces, quote, attempts to change the regional balance through proxies. Yet Iran is actively destabilizing Lebanon, Yemen, Bahrain, and many other Middle Eastern countries. Rouhani promises, quote, constructive engagement with other countries.
He's right, you know, about Iran backing Assad in Syria. And although I don't know, I missed the beginning of it. I'm sure he's politely leaving out the fact that the Iraqis are helping him. The Iraqis that he demanded America invade and regime change that country in favor of the Shiites who are now helping Iran back Syria. Go and you can read Netanyahu's speech, his statement to the U.S. Congress, his speech to the U.S. Congress in 2002, demanding regime change in Iraq. This very same guy. And of course, his ambassador to the United States said just last week that, yeah, well, we support the Al-Qaeda bad guys in Syria because they're fighting against Hezbollah, and Hezbollah's backed by Iran. That's Israel's policy. So,
ladies and gentlemen,
they concede that they support terrorism. They support Al-Qaeda terrorism. As long as it's against Hezbollah, why not?
Because facts are stubborn things.
That's what I'm saying.
And the facts are that Iran's savage record flatly contradicts Rouhani's soothing rhetoric. Last Friday, Rouhani assured us that in pursuit of its nuclear program, Iran, this is a quote, Iran has never chosen deceit and secrecy. Never chosen deceit and secrecy. Well, in 2002, Iran was caught red-handed, secretly building an underground centrifuge facility in Natanz.
Which is not illegal.
In 2009, Iran was again caught red-handed, secretly building.
Yeah, 4 days after they declared it to the IAEA, they were caught.
For uranium enrichment in a mountain near Qom.
You like being lied to much?
He tells us not to worry. He assures us that all of this is not intended for nuclear weapons. Any of you believe that? If you believe that, here's a few questions you might want to ask. Why would a country that claims to only want peaceful nuclear energy, Why would such a country build hidden underground enrichment facilities? Why would a country with vast natural energy reserves invest billions in developing nuclear energy?
Why would a country sell oil? There's not much of an international market to sell uranium.
Civilian
run your electricity off of uranium and sell your oil for
continue
money.
Continue to defy multiple Security what Council resolutions
do.
And incur the tremendous cost of crippling sanctions on its economy. And why would a country with a peaceful nuclear program develop intercontinental ballistic missiles whose sole purpose is to deliver nuclear warheads?
Yeah, based on what evidence? The Israeli forged alleged ICBMs studies documents. Give me a break. Is this really
away.
The best that they've
you build
got
them for
still?
One purpose to carry nuclear warheads. And Iran is building now ICBMs that the United States says could reach.
This is all
this
they've got is just bull.
In 3 or 4 years.
Just innuendo. Nothing.
Why would they do all this?
Everyone knows that Iran is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has a safeguards agreement. They are not enriching uranium to weapons grade. That is an absolute fact. That they are not enriching weapons grade uranium. They have nothing to make nuclear bombs out of. Netanyahu knows that. Everyone in the room that he's yelling at knows that. And he's a damn liar, and so now you know that too.
Advanced centrifuges. It also continued work on the heavy water reactor in Iraq. That's in order to have.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is the Scott Horton Show. So I had to play that break there, and in the meantime, Netanyahu says they're making nuclear weapons. I was reading the closed captions. I didn't see every bit of it, but I'm pretty sure he didn't make any reference to the fact that Iran keeps diverting their nuclear stockpile, you know, to electricity and medical purposes, just like they said. They keep taking that 20% rich uranium that everybody, that the Israelis are so concerned about. And they're turning it into fuel plates for their medical isotope reactor that the USA built for them back when their dictatorship was an American-backed dictatorship in the 1970s. You know, so they can cure people's cancer and stuff like that. That's what they're doing with it. Just what they said they were gonna. Amazing. And anyway, you know what? I'm reminded of what Ali Gharib was saying the other day, which is that Benjamin Netanyahu is a joke. He's not even really playing the game. He's, well, sort of like me. He's just a kook in the stands yelling and screaming. His voice doesn't matter much more than mine does, really. He's just some guy complaining. And, I don't know. Jason had the negative spin on it, antiwar.com, which is fair enough. But the McClatchy story today took the positive outlook on Obama's statement yesterday, which was, we are very concerned about all of Israel's concerns. And yet, thanks, but we're going to go ahead and negotiate. Believe me, we're taking your concerns into account. Boy, and if they start to try to make a nuke, we'll bomb the hell out of them. All options are on the table, says tough guy President Obama. However, yeah, we're going to go ahead and have these talks. So, I don't know. I think really that, and maybe this is wishful thinking. Maybe this should be the question of the day for callers on the show. I think that Benjamin Netanyahu has jumped the shark. I think nobody takes him seriously anymore. You know, somebody let the Iranian foreign minister say on ABC Sunday morning that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu has said we're 6 months away from a nuclear bomb since 1991. And it hasn't been true this whole time. So really, this guy's a joke, right? Something like that. And I think that, you know what? I think a lot of people kind of heard that and nodded. It's sort of like even Condoleezza Rice. Remember that great anecdote of Condoleezza Rice telling Douglas Feith, thanks, Doug, but when we need to hear what Ariel Sharon's view is, we'll ask him. You know, kind of a thing. Yeah, thanks, Netanyahu. When we need to know what Netanyahu's point of view is, we'll ask you. Meanwhile, go talk it yourself. And you know what? I'm sorry to get my hopes up for this thing. I shouldn't, and I shouldn't be encouraging anybody else to get their hopes up for this thing. But here's the thing of it. Is the halfway between Iran's position and America's position, it's easy as pie. It's right there for everyone to see the deal. And you could be your first week interested in foreign policy and see the outlines of the deal. We will lift the sanctions and promise not to bomb you. If you will stop enriching up to 20%, which is still nowhere near 94%, but anyway, Benjamin Netanyahu is, you know, I don't know, 15.9% more scared of 20% enriched uranium than the 3 point whatever. Sorry, I'm terrible at arithmetic on the live radio here, I admit. But anyway, you stop enriching up to 20%. Now that you have all you need for your medical isotope reactor anyway. And go ahead and put all that 3.6% to use in your electricity program as fast as you can. Turn it into fuel rods, etc., so that you can't make it, you know, continue to enrich it up to weapons grade. Maybe sign the additional protocol to the safeguards agreement. Even John Kerry said that. Get him to sign the additional protocol. Okay, so that means expanded inspections, surprise inspections instead of scheduled ones and whatever. And maybe answer more questions that are based on Israeli forgeries, like the alleged studies documents, that kind of thing. And, you know, in other words, continue to be innocent of all charges and in a very easily verifiable and provable way, and we'll lift the sanctions and promise not to kill you. It's really on America to make the deal now. They're negotiating. They're already dealing in good faith. It's up to America to prove that they're willing to now. It's up to the Obama team to prove that they're willing to. But all I'm saying is the basis for the deal is so obvious and so easy. You know, the Iranians, they already, under Khatami, they went by the additional protocol to the safeguards agreement for 2.5 years. Maybe more than that. 3 years before, and their parliament hadn't even ratified it. Just Khatami had signed it, and the supreme leader said, go ahead and abide by that. And I know that sounds boring and complicated, paperwork or whatever, but what it means is expanded access to the international nuke cops. Go ahead and have the run of the place. And it included, at that time, a complete freezing of any enrichment. You know, when Netanyahu says, oh, we caught him red-handed in 2002, he's talking about a hole in the ground. You can go and find the BBC story where the BBC reporters were taken on a tour of the Natanz facility in 2005, and it's still just a big, empty warehouse. There wasn't a single centrifuge spinning in there. They weren't in violation of their safeguards agreement unless they were within 6 months of introducing nuclear fuel into the facilities there, which they were years away from still. And the same thing with the comm facility. First of all, he lied when he said that they were caught red-handed. Still to this day, even, what's her name, who I am oftentimes a fan of her journalism on this issue, from the Atlantic Council. I'm sorry, her name is escaping me for a minute. But even she went for this thing about how, Obama caught Iran red-handed making the comm facility. Really? Well, let's see, the timeline is they declared the comm facility to the IAEA, and then 4 days later, Obama, Cameron, and Sarkozy gave a joint conference thing where Obama pretended to out them for what they had declared 4 days earlier. And then they just made up this theory after the fact that, well, they only declared it because they knew that we were about to out them for it. Oh, yeah? Well, how's that? In fact, Glenn Greenwald at the time wrote an essay called "The Singular Unproven Assertion at the Heart of This Comm Story." Unproven assertion is, I know, part of the headline. And it somehow, some anonymous administration official is quoted as saying that he may believe that perhaps they only declared it to the IAEA because they knew they were about to get busted for it. Really? But with no explanation as to how it was that the Iranians knew. Did they have a spy on Obama's speech-writing staff, perhaps? Is it even a verifiable fact that Obama had decided to out them before they declared it? Did they even prove the chronology? Or is it not the case that Iran declared it and then Obama just lied and pretended to surprise out them for what was at the time a hole in the ground, still more than a year away from the introduction of any nuclear material? Perfectly within the guidelines and for what they had announced 4 days earlier. It's amazing the crap that they get away with, man. You know, it's all you got to do is tell David Sanger in the New York Times, well, you see, we may believe that perhaps they somehow knew, although we're not going to explain to you how they could have possibly known, but they somehow knew that Obama was going to out them, and so they hurried up and admitted it first. Pfft, whatever. And again, they weren't in violation of the safeguards agreement. They weren't doing anything wrong. It's all just hot air this whole time. And anyway, so Benjamin Netanyahu is a clown. That's the point. The thing is, it's all over the place. Even, somewhat mainstream, I think I saw on TV and certainly in mainstream papers, they're talking about, well, of course, you know, the Israelis need to have an enemy in common for, you know, to get American sympathy and support and all that. And if America has a real rapprochement with Iran, then that will weaken Israel's position in the U.S. Congress. You know? Who's going to keep paying their way? And so they need to keep tensions high. And, you know, my thing is this. There's a poll out that says 75% of the American people support Obama's decision to try to talk with the Iranians and work out our differences. Whew, wow, really? And then Netanyahu comes and says, hey, look at me. I'm the only one in the world who doesn't want this. Oh, yeah. And my fifth column sock puppets in your country. We're the only ones who don't want this deal. Screw you, American people who live here. This isn't about you. And I think that, hey, you know, it's They're treading thin. Go back to, say, for example, and I know this is just whether or not we're going to have a peace deal, not whether or not we're going to launch a war, but still it's a useful metaphor, kind of an examination of a situation, sort of a thingamajig there. When you look at the Bush coalition, the domestic coalition that Bush put together for the invasion of Iraq. Now, that thing was led by Bush and Cheney and the White House and the Principals Committee. And the neocons, boy, were they instrumental in making it happen. But that thing was really led from the very top. And the entire Republican Party was brought on board. The entire American media was brought on board very quickly for it. And, of course, the leadership of the Democrats, people like Bill Clinton, who had only been the governor at the time, but still, and John Kerry and others who had opposed Democrats, who had opposed the first Gulf War, well, they were forever embarrassed by that because the first Gulf War was just great, as everyone agrees. And so, you know, they went ahead and got on board. They weren't going to risk that again when everyone was sure that Donald Rumsfeld was going to do such a good job, you know, on the second time around there. And the neocons were instrumental in putting all this together and in keeping the heat up and in making sure that they had a guy writing for every editorial page in the world, or in America, anyway. One guy, I mean, there was only, what, you know, 60 neocons in the world? But each of them had a gig at a newspaper and as a talking head on a TV show. And all of them are the expert guests from all the think tanks and whatever. But imagine that same situation if it had been just them. If it hadn't been Bush and Cheney and the whole Republican Party and the whole media and everybody, but if it had just been the neocons and Ariel Sharon's office, you know, and their little office of special plans they created over there to manufacture bogus intelligence in English to funnel straight into the stovepipe intelligence, you know, lie transmission belt to the White House. What if it just been them? That's kind of what this is. You know? Obama doesn't want a war with Iran. Thank goodness, he's far too cowardly to take on a big project like that. Whew. And then, you know, I don't know, the media would be for it. I guess if they could sell some more dish soap, they don't care. But, you know, wars are exciting. Look at how quickly they all got on board for the Syria thing a couple of weeks ago. And not even embarrassed that it didn't work out for them either. Let's move right on. But anyway, I think, hopefully, I'm going on and on, but I'm just saying I'm hopeful that this is really bad for the Israel lobby and for the Likud government and the amount of power and influence that they wield in Washington, D.C. I mean, after all, don't they already look bad after pushing so hard for the airstrikes in Syria that the American people were unanimous against? The only people pushing for it on Capitol Hill, AIPAC. And what were they doing? They were going around telling the congressman that Assad and Al-Qaeda are the bad guys together in it. No, Al-Qaeda are the ones that you're supporting against Assad, and even the dumbest congressman knows that. Or is at least afraid that he thinks he might have heard that somewhere or something, you know? And they didn't go for it. So already, you know, I think they're strutting around without cause, exercising power that is waning dramatically. And the American people now, you can get people to all call Congress in opposition to a war. Can you get everybody to call Congress in support of peace? You know, screw a health care plan. We demand you support the president on talks with Iran. You bastards. How about that for the next town meeting? I don't know. That's what Ali Gharib was saying, that, you know, I think that they've overplayed their hand, basically. And nobody takes Netanyahu seriously anymore. I mean, hell, I don't take him seriously. I was going to sort of kind of let him talk and then kind of commentate on it, but I don't really care what he has to say to you. We all know what he means. They're never giving up the West Bank. They'll sit there and pretend that there's going to be a Palestinian state, but they're not. And he's going to sit there and he's going to demand a halt to all things nuclear in Iran, which he knows is never going to happen, which is meant only to be a poison pill and marching orders to the American neoconservative fifth column to try to disrupt the peace talks. And then what's the rest of it? A bunch of hot air in my ear. With the voice that's about as annoying as Sarah Palin's. So, whatever. Middle finger to you, Mr. Prime Minister. I ain't care much for what you say. All right. Here's something that's important. Police abuse. And here's people who do a real good job on this lately is Trevor Lyman, and I'm not sure who's helping him. Maybe it's just him. I don't know. The Liberty Crier. And he does a real good job of keeping track of these local police abuse stories. And there's just so many of them. I think that's the real point without getting all the way into the deepest details on each of them is just to point out the endless catalog of domestic police abuse in America, and most of it local cops. And the thing of it is, it's social media. It's the World Wide Web 2.0, man, is what makes the difference. Now, local news is national news. And that's whether it's, you know, pop star's belly button is showing, or police release German Shepherd to bite the throat of prone, already shackled, unarmed teenager who's already being beaten by a few cops before the German Shepherd is even sicked on the kid. What the hell is this, man? If this was somebody else's country, if this was China, this would be a headline in America. Man, look at these Chinese police. They beat the hell out of this guy, and then they release a German Shepherd onto his neck. Holy crap, it's a communist dictatorship over there. All of America would agree. If it was the splinter in someone else's eye. A handicapped man is dragged from his wheelchair and slammed to the ground. There's the video there from Bad Cops on Camera. Oh, that's the other thing. It's the social media, but it's also, it's that Android and that iPhone too, right? Record, record, record. YouTube, upload, blam. Bad Cops on Camera. Cop Block, of course, does a hell of a lot of great work on all this stuff. Radley Balco, who's a Catoite, is now writing for the Huffington Post, which I think is great because he's getting a lot of coverage there and a lot of less partisan eyes. And here's one. Dallas County has now gone and drove down to Fort Hood to pick up their MRAP, which I'm sorry, I meant to ask Ann Jones about her, she talks in the article about how the MRAP wasn't all that mine-resistant after all. Through all that hype, which I had read that actually they were pretty well preferred to the Humvees and the Abrams tanks and whatever else they had, and Bradleys, whatever else they had to drive around in most of the time. But I don't know, what do I know? She seemed to really dispute that in her Tom Dispatch piece. But anyway, the point of an MRAP is these things are absolutely useless for domestic policing. These have no actual application. You know, we've all seen real stories of the highway patrol where the two bank robbers from 1996 armed, you know, with AK-47s robbed the Bank of America in Los Angeles. But yeah, the reason that's notable is because that was the only time that ever happened. Guys unloading with their AK-47s, you know, on full auto against an army of LAPD like that, and the whole thing filmed by helicopters and all the rest of it. That kind of thing doesn't happen so often. What this is about, well, first of all, is it's just welfare. It's boys and their toys, you know, and welfare for the cops. It's welfare for the manufacturers. Helps, you know, keep generals promoted and all those individual interests involved. But ultimately, this is about a decision to use the Powell Doctrine on the American people. And the Powell Doctrine basically is really, didn't it start out as the Weinberger Doctrine? And maybe it was, I'm getting them confused now, but it could have been the General Abrams Doctrine that they named the tank after. And that doctrine was no more Vietnams. From now on, we go in there and we completely knock the crap out of them and we win the war in a week. Done. Like Iraq War I. That was the perfect model for how the Pentagon wanted to fight. Go in there and drop every bomb in their inventory and then come back in a few years and do it again. Good times. That was what they wanted. Go in there with overwhelming force, achieve whatever their limited objective, and then withdraw. And so they've just adopted this to call it the Waco Doctrine. They've adopted this to domestic policing. Instead of come out with your hands up, come on, Dave, we know you're in there. Come on out now and face the music. We've got all day. You're going to get thirsty at some point. Instead of that, it's Waco-style dynamic overwhelming force. Military, para, military. What does that mean, para? It means they work for the civilian government. They claim to be civilians even though they're just special forces, soldiers. Military raids on people's homes. And, you know, I've talked about this for years and years about the armored personnel carriers. They've had an armored personnel carrier, not an MRAP. They've had an armored personnel carrier here. The Austin police has for more than 10 years now. At least they used to park it right where you could see it there on 7th Street downtown in their garage. And the point is, it's intimidation. Like Bill Hicks said way back in 1993 or something. That's why they show you the show Cops in the first place, so that you know that state power will always win, that they will bust your house down if it comes down to it, that there's no point in really trying to resist them. And they come rolling up to your door in an MRAP. You know, I guess they're thinking, to put it charitably, their thinking is they don't have to kill you. They'll just, you know, like Benjamin Netanyahu's policy. They'll just terrify you into submission with their big, bad truck. And you got to admit, one of those things would probably be pretty fun to drive. And so if your job is waging war against people in your own neighborhood, but it's all under the color of law and legitimacy and your hat over your heart at a ball game and all that crap, then might as well do it, right? One time I met a U.S. Air Force guy. He might have been lying that he was really a pilot. Air Force guys can be kind of bravado. I could see how one who always wanted to be a pilot but never got to be might have pretended or something. But at the very least, he was parroting them. This was back before 9/11. This was the cause of 9/11. And we were talking about, it was a guy who rode in my cab, and we were talking about the no-fly zone over Iraq. And he was talking about how much fun it was to turn people into hamburger meat. And, you know, use overwhelming force against them. It is what got us attacked. Waging war against the civilians of Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia all through the Clinton years, you know. But anyway, so his whole thing was, you know, turning people into hamburger meat. But it was all okay because it was all red, white, and blue and the color of law and the military and we take care of more before 5 a.m. than most people do all day and all that legitimacy. The hat over your heart at the ball game and all that stuff that matters so much made it perfectly okay. Murder people all day. And they let me fly a plane. Like a badass one, too. Not like, you know, flying a jumbo jet, which that'd be pretty fun, I guess. But seriously, you know, any of us who are boys have at least entertained the idea that maybe it'd be worth it to join the Air Force if we got a chance to fly F-15s or something, right? We all saw Top Gun and thought, wow, what fun that would be. Even if I had to kill people, they're all foreigners. And if the commander-in-chief says it's okay, then it's okay. Like that time we defeated the Nazis in the World War II. If you wear green, thou shalt not kill is suspended. As long as you're in uniform. And following democratic governmental orders, right? Something like that. The same kind of thing for being a deputy sheriff driving an MRAP and crashing straight into somebody's house. Bashing in their door like the German Gestapo. In fact, the German Gestapo, you know, look, they hauled a lot of people out, machine gunned them to death. I ain't saying that. But I think a lot of times they would just knock on the door, come pick your ass up, and show their faces too. Horrible murderers, proud of their work. In America, the cops, they know that they're wrong. They know they're guilty. They hide their names. They hide their faces. Why do you think SWAT cops all cover their faces? Because they're afraid that every house is booby-trapped in America, right? Like, we're all just a bunch of insurgents in a war. Oh, well, we're afraid of a fireball in our face. Really? Well, who's got the flashbang grenades, guys? The real thing is, it's a disguise, like a robber's mask, because they know that they're wrong, but they just figure who cares, and they'll rationalize it to themselves, like, yeah, I like turning people into hamburger meat, because immorality is moral if I just turn it upside down and pretend to myself. You know, they've done the studies over and over, not just the Milgram study, but you got, like, the Stanford Prison Experiment, whatever. You take the average Joe, have him pretend, and know he's pretending for a college experiment. Tell him up front, Joe, you're pretending for a college experiment. Now go in there and pretend that you're a prison guard. And within a day, they're acting like hardcore Nazis, abusing the prisoners. Within a week, within 2 weeks, they had to shut down the whole thing. Because of the torture and degradation and humiliation dished out by regular kid college students acting out the part of normal prison guards. You know, in America, where we believe in the Bill of Rights and all of that. I mean, geez, even if you're in prison, you got some rights, don't you? Even if you're, what if you're pretending to be a prisoner? And the guy who's pretending to be the guard knows that you're just pretending to be the prisoner. You haven't been convicted of murdering anybody or anything. But no. Real torture and beatings and horrible humiliations. They had to call the whole thing off. Give people even the pretension of the color of law. And they'll drive an MRAP through your front yard, even if your front yard is full of baby toys, even if the neighbors are outside screaming, no, wait, they got babies in there, you know what they'll do. Same as Waco, they'll go anyway. And it's funny, keep your eyes out for, keep your ears open for police referring to everybody else as civilians, as though they aren't civilians. Hey, look, in America, there's the military and then there's the civilians, okay? Even if you're a government employee, you're a civilian. Unless you're a soldier or a marine or a sailor or an airman or a Coast Guardian or whatever, I don't know what they call the Coast Guardians. Otherwise, you're a civilian. But listen to the cops more and more imply that, no, they're not. Everybody except them is because after all they're playing a military role, And you know what? I know, because I was once a fourth grader, that it's fun to run around with toy guns and to drive around in toy tanks, probably, too. So, you know, there's the crux of what we're up against, is now you've given these guys an MRAP, take it away from them. And watch the police union cry their eyes out. Oh, it ain't fair to take our tank away. Now you've given it to them, try to take it back. Now that you've given them all machine guns, and given them all their fancy ninja warrior costumes to wear instead of their Don Knotts outfit, see if you can demilitarize them now. See if you can get your state legislature to pass a law called the Re-Civilianizing of the Police Act of 2013. No more paramilitary you unless it's a hostage situation. And oh, watch them kick and scream. You give them an inch, they'll take the rest of your Bill of Rights. That's it. They will militarize. They don't need to use the army. They don't need to declare martial law. Your local sheriff's department already is a paramilitary death squad. And, you know, you keep your eye on the Liberty Crier. You see this stuff every day. Will Griggs blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Radley Balco over at the Huffington Post. You know, there are, on average, 200 SWAT team raids a day in this country. 200. Are Americans that bad of people? We got that many serial killers being hunted? That many hostage situations at banks? You let them have a special weapons assault team for a hostage situation at a bank in major cities like L.A. or Chicago, where that kind of thing ever happens, where you have machine gun battles going on over a bank robbery, and you end up with a paramilitary death squad. Again, para. What's para mean? A military death squad as at least part of the local sheriff's department in every county in America. Every city police agency in America. And boy, they will stop paving your roads long before they stop funding your local military special weapons assault team. You want a government shutdown? Let's start with the totalitarianism, okay? We'll keep the food stamps going and the Medicaid going until we can come up with private alternatives with all the money we save. Abolishing the police state and the empire. Taking all the MRAPs and melting that steel down and making something useful out of it. You know, as determined by prices on the market. Or just dump it all in the Gulf and make a reef out of it, you know? Lord knows the real coral reefs are all dying. You might as well dump some MRAPs in the sea. Anyway, Dallas County Police to execute warrants in 15-ton vehicle capable of withstanding, quote, nuclear environment. Yeah, that's what they tell your nephew, the Army specialist, driving around in that thing. But anyway, crazy. And you know, the solution to the roadside bomb problem in Iraq and Afghanistan was never the MRAP. It was withdrawal. What the hell are you doing occupying other people's countries? Remember, it would have been 2007 or 8. I think it was actually Hastings. Michael Hastings reported on the show about some army soldiers who, what they did every day was they would go out in their Humvee to a field where they were pretty sure there were no booby traps. And they would just park their Humvee and chill and listen to the radio. They were just over it. Man, I'm not, what am I doing driving around playing the IED lottery? I'm not accomplishing anything. My orders are, go drive around. What, just to draw fire? You know what? You go die. I'm going to sit in a field. sir. Yes, I will check in every hour. Yep, here we are. We're still in the field. I mean, we're driving around patrolling. Woo, we just missed one. Boy, that was close. And then back to, you know, I guess smoking reefer and listening to Jimi Hendrix, right? Wrong war. That's the real solution to the roadside bomb. Stop patrolling where you got no business trespassing on other people's property. Then it really won't matter the shape of the underside of your giant steel truck. Anyway. The Liberty Crier. They do a real good job on police abuse over there. All right. And then, you know, I forgot what I was going to say. I had one more thing. I guess I will just say this. In case you're new and you don't know, if you've been around and you do know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound patronizing and stupid or whatever, but there are a lot of new people all the time, so I got to let them know. There's a thing called the Austrian business cycle theory. And what it says is, you know how sometimes times are good, and then all of a sudden it's a recession, and everybody's broken out of a job, and then, hey, times seem like they're kind of good again for a little while, and then, oh, the bubble pops, and then things get bad. Well, the reason why, it isn't because of the wilds of laissez-faire free market capitalism. It's because of the government's manipulation of the interest rates and the money supply. And they make it seem like there's a bunch of extra wealth, so people invest in a bunch of projects that end up going nowhere when it all falls apart on the same day, as we saw 5 years ago last week. So, anyway, that's how it works. Read all about it. It's the Austrian business cycle theory. Okay, see you tomorrow.